This is the European edition of Breaking Banks, the world's number one fintech podcast and radio show. We bring you the European unicorns, startups, founders, regulators, and leaders innovating the rapidly evolving fintech scene today. A truly localized podcast with both English and local language content with some of the world's most well-known hosts and influencers in the fintech sector globally. Join us every week as we explore what makes the European Union a phenomenal proving ground for many of the fastest growing fintech plays in the world today. Okay, let's roll.
Hello, and welcome to the 35th episode of Breaking Banks Europe. Today we have a very special guest in Liz Brandt. Liz is the founder and CEO of Control Shift, a specialist consultancy, a data and innovation company that specializes in growth and privacy. And today's topic is tailor-made for Liz. It's about AI and privacy. And Liz, you've been advising Facebook and a number of other high-tech companies. Could you please say hello to our guests and introduce yourself?
Hi, yeah, great. Thanks very much for the introduction, Ajit. And it's great to be here. As you said, I am the co-founder and chief exec of Control Shift. We specialize in how to use personal data to enable growth and sustainable growth. We've been working with, as you say, high-tech companies such as Facebook, but also banks, telecommunications companies, energy companies, many blue chip companies over the last 10 years to look at the trajectory of this market. How do we actually enable and empower individuals with data, and how do we to enable us to engender trust in our data market? And how do we then use that data to create value for organizations, society, and individuals?
That's fascinating. So, you know, Facebook, and I know you can't tell us too much about your work with your clients specifically, but Facebook is a company that always gets me excited in a good way and in a bad way. So I think they're a brilliant AI company, right? The quality of their products, the sheer amount of engineering that goes into some of their products is just incredible. I'm a big fan as an engineer myself. But at the same time, they're always in the news for privacy issues, right? And I think of them as an archetypal AI company that is always in trouble when it comes to privacy issues. What's really going on there?
Well, as you say, I can't talk about exactly what's going on. But I think what we can reflect on is that if you are at the very front edge of this market, you're going to run into all of the landmines as you go forward. And I think any company would be. And in fact, many, many are. It's just that I think Facebook tends to be in the news more and is easy to identify. But I think what is right that you talk about AI and personal data is that interjection between the two is where we can do good and we can do bad, if you want to call it that. But wrapped up in that, it's not just about whether or not the AI can do the work and whether or not you can get to the data. It does become a little philosophical because you start getting into the governance and the ethics. And that can, in some instances, translate into, and many organizations it does, translate into a compliance question. Whereas actually, it should translate into a growth question, because the opportunity for AI and data is not just how do I make my products better and how do I sell more things. There is a much, much bigger opportunity that we can all go for, where that data becomes a huge opportunity for us all as individuals to manage our lives more effectively. And in doing that, we can actually create more value for businesses, in our economies, and we can create more value in our societies. So if we can focus on that value opportunity, how do we use AI and personal data to do that? And then what's the governance framework and ethics that goes around that to enable it? I think that will help us all move forward hugely.
Yeah, no, that sounds, you know, in the abstract, that sounds all very good. Now, there are a few trends. So most of our audience is, you know, financial services and fintech. And one of the trends in fintech is that big tech is starting to take over, right? So Shopify, Amazon, Facebook is issuing Libra, and that's caused a lot of European regulators to be very concerned about what it means for digital identity, for the privacy of transact data for system risk and so on. And we're not going to focus on Facebook, but we are going to focus on Silicon Valley's approach to data, which is about, you know, using customers' data and selling them advertisements back. And that's kind of been the dominant business model in Silicon Valley for a while. And that's not something that works for banks, right? So banks have historically struggled to monetize data because they don't have the kind of freedom that Silicon Valley does. Now with Silicon Valley coming into fintech in a big way, and starting to issue cards and other payments products and so on, is consumers' data at the risk of privacy violations at to the same extent?
So I think this comes down to what are banks for. And as you say, the thought that they will use this to support an advertising model, data to support an advertising model, I think runs completely counter to what are banks for. You could also say that banks might think they are a risk business and therefore the data is for risk. But actually, banks are there to enable our economies and enable people to live their lives. And I think there's a refocusing. Our work in banks has very much been around a refocusing on the purpose of banks and how data can enable them to be more purposeful and more relevant in people's lives. So there's and in doing that, there are incredible opportunities for new business models and new types of revenue that aren't about advertising, are more about helping people and through that creating new revenues. Let's face it, you know, many products that are out there at the moment are about helping people. Advertising is just a way of getting those products to people. So my dishwasher definitely helps me. It's just a product. Whereas actually what we're looking at now is the opportunity to create products that help people from data. So for a bank, if a bank can help somebody better manage their money, and there are a number of these coming up through open banking and personal financial management tools, then suddenly they're relevant in people's lives. They're not just about making a payment and just tapping and making a payment and buying things and spending money. They're helping them manage their money more effectively. Maybe they're saving up for a holiday, helping them get better education, finding a new job. All those things are about helping me with my life. And data can do that. And data can help banks do that and become highly relevant in people's lives. And you know, completely leapfrog over the business model of advertising. And I'm not saying advertising is going away. All I'm saying is, if the only thing we can think of doing with data is advertising, then the human race thinks it, the human race is a sad thing.
Yeah, and to be honest, Silicon Valley over the last 10 years is a bit of a sad thing. If we are to believe Marc Andreessen. And, you know, so Marc Andreessen and Ben Horowitz have said in their A16Z podcast, in as many words, that maybe Silicon Valley needs to go through a crisis so that we can invent new business models that do not rely on using data to sell ads, right? Now, with banks, I have done some consulting work in the past, and part of the problem is banks don't have two things, right? One, we don't have the level of the scale of data that Silicon Valley does. So we have transaction data, we have user data, but it's mostly structured data and it's finite in size. So it's not really built for the kind of deep learning algorithms that Silicon Valley relies on. The second part is that banks are heavily restricted from using some of that data for various purposes, right? So yes, we can draw graphs and charts, we can offer some personal financial management tools, but we can't really do the kind of mind reading algorithms that you know Silicon Valley is known for. And now we are talking about AI and privacy. So the fact that banks are custodians of data and are much more restricted in using data, I mean, that also means that they're restricted in applying AI to consumer benefit to the same extent that Silicon Valley can. Am I wrong? Am I missing something?
I think this is where you come back to governance. And it's not going to take just banks to do this. It's going to take banks and regulators to work through how we create this value. And we've been doing quite a lot of work where we work with blue chip organizations such as Barclays or HSBC, plus the likes of Facebook, plus the likes of Centrica, BT, BBC, but bringing with us regulators, looking at how you use data, personal data, to create new value. But we've been looking especially at how that data is held and enabled for the individual. Because if you're doing it with and for the individual, then you're acting under a different governance structure. Or you need to create a different governance structure. Sure, if you're doing it to work out what your risk profiles are and how to manage your business, that's one. But we've been working with the Financial Conduct Authority in the UK, the Information Commissioner's Office, the Competitions Market Authority. What are the new models when you use data in the hands of the individual to create this new value? Now, I think banks have a fantastic opportunity here because they are brilliant at governance. I worked for a bank for 12 years. We were really hot. And I know it's got even hotter. So if you can apply that, if you can design the right governance structure for this new value opportunity, and then apply the skills that banks have in spades, then we are, you know, the banks will go miles ahead of everybody else. At the moment, however, Facebook, shimmied along by the regulators, are creating new governance structures.
So,
and 2 years in, they will have created a governance structure that could well supersede the governance capabilities of banks. So there's not much hang around for this.
So Liz, help me here. They're going to remove that big hack sign out of their headquarters, and they're going to stop, just hacking overnight and creating new products. And they will suddenly have steering committees like banks that approve or disapprove their products. Is that where they're going?
Well, I think the first one you're right on. So they removed those about 2 years ago. But I think that the question here is, what is the governance structure in a dynamic, fast-moving digital market? Because, a hierarchical structure with steering groups and...
Working committees, oh God.
No, and it's not in anybody's interest to create that, because we're not going to get to the value fast enough. So how do we move that along fast enough? So it's not just designing the governance, it's designing a new organisational structure, a new culture that goes behind it. So the challenges are not small, but the prizes are huge. And if you look at something like Facebook, they've already got a very podular culture. The structure is very podular, and the culture is very dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have strong governance. If you look at a bank, they have strong governance, but they do not have a podular, dynamic structure or culture. So they can't dynamically bring together teams of people. They can't focus on a problem, solve a problem, produce a new product, move on. They have a very hierarchical, as we know, structure that reflects their governance requirements from their regulator.
Yes.
And this isn't just their problem. This is also the regulator's problem.
It is, for sure. So, I'm going to ask you one last question about Facebook. So their head of AI, Yann LeCun, has just Twitter in a blaze of glory because they had some algorithms, and I'm a big fan of Yann as a student of AI, and because apparently some of the algorithms they applied had a certain amount of bias to them. So what those algorithms allow you to do is, if you have a blurry face, right, a low sample, a low resolution image, then you can actually apply some of the sampling and some of the deep learning algorithms to recreate the actual image from there. And apparently those algorithms work better for certain ethnicities and don't work better for certain other ethnicities. So, this whole idea of resampling and the whole idea of recreating people's images and data from data that might be obfuscated is not just a bias issue, it's also a privacy issue, right? So the natural tendency for engineers like me and others is to essentially solve the technical problem and not necessarily worry about some of the other implications, right? Some of the ethical and other privacy implications of the data. Now, so that's a bit of a culture change for big tech. And as it enters into financial services, as big tech starts to invade financial services, that culture isn't going to change overnight, right? We can create whatever governance, but Silicon Valley is proud of fail fast, move fast, and break things. So if we're going to launch a Libra and we're going to launch Shopify products and so on, is it simply a matter of regulators going to these big tech firms and saying, guys, just you need to create a governance structure? How are we going to drive the culture change?
That's interesting, isn't it? So I think here in the UK, the government have been trying to move fast and fail fast. And I think they've broken a few things as far as trying to do things like our COVID app. So I think
that one.
And I don't do that because I want to point at it and mock it, but I think it's about our perception of an organisation and how they need to be solid and reliable. And if they don't move in a certain way, whether that undermines our trust and our belief in them. So, we have. So therefore, if you try and apply that, if you think about that and apply that to banks, there is a brand challenge in this, that move fast, fail fast culture. It is going to be quite counter, not just to the culture, but also to the brand. Mm-hmm. At the same time, when you get the likes of the big tech companies trying to move into the finance sector, you may find that they culturally don't fit into that because people don't trust them enough mm-hmm. to be reliable and solid enough to actually manage their finances. Having said that, they can pick away at the low-hanging fruit that's got all the profit in it and leave the bank.
Yeah, that's what my friend David Birch says. They're just picking the cream on top of the cake.
Of course. There's no money in the pipes. So what do we end up with? We end up with banks that are just pipes, and that means that they're lumbered with all the risk, they're lumbered with all the regulation, but they haven't got the profit, which basically puts our finance market globally under threat. Another challenge for our regulators. They can't just sit back and wait for this to happen, although obviously it's good to get more competition into the market, which is how PSD2 is operating, but they can't just sit back and let the whole system fail. So we've got to find a way of doing it. So therefore, I think that the regulators have got to be facing in two directions, one towards the big tech and two towards the banks. So they've got to be pushing back on big techs and pushing forward with the banks. And I think they're doing a jolly good job in doing that. You know, the work that's been going on, for instance, the Treasury report, the Thurman review and the Treasury report in the UK, the further review of the Competitions Market Authority on the online advertising market, pushing back into the big tech market. And then you've got what's going on with open banking and the advisory group that I sit on in the open finance market, where they're looking at moving open banking into pensions and insurance, mm-hmm. forcing the banks to move and change their culture. What I see is not a technical project. What I see is a culture change project. I see a whole program of work that's about transformation of a sector, but not just a transformation of a sector, but transformation ostensibly of our economy and our way of living. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think there's a big job. The regulators are working very, very hard.
Yeah.
To move both in different into a common direction.
So this is I use a line to annoy my fellow Europeans, and this is how it goes: China is innovating, US is designing, and Europe is regulating. Okay, so now we have covered this whole regulation and crisis side of the privacy and AI issue. What about the opportunity? When you go to your clients, what opportunities do you talk to them about? What products or services should we be creating in Europe, in fintech, that will, using privacy and AI as the sources of opportunity? What's out there? Because I just don't hear enough about people creating AI-driven products that somehow use privacy as an asset rather than as a problem.
Yeah, well, that's actually a very big question. So as you well know, we've got a number of layers, if you want to call it, of value that can be created in our personal information and the AI market. And one of the big ones is infrastructure. And the infrastructure embeds in the standards and the governance and the ethics that we've talked about around how to get that data to flow. And I often think about it as similar to an electricity market. So how do we get the electricity to flow safely to people's homes? Therein lies a massive opportunity. So many conversations with banks and the like around the opportunities there. And then on top of that, there's opportunities to help people to make better decisions and manage their life more effectively.
What would be an example of such a product?
Yes.
What have you seen in the market?
So things that are being worked on and we publicly are working on are things like helping people manage their mental health, helping mm-hmm. people to more responsibly manage their finances, helping people to manage their careers, helping people to get startup businesses, get back into work, helping people to build out their social life. So there's a whole swathe of value opportunities that sit on top of that infrastructure. So the two layers fit together. And we've got to have the infrastructure layer to make the top layer work. Mm-hmm. Banks are very good at the infrastructure, brilliant at the infrastructure.
For sure.
And I think there's a massive opportunity there. We did some work some while back with Swift looking at what they call the digital asset grid. And mm-hmm. I think that still persists. That work is still relevant today, how banks can actually enable that data to flow and safely flow around the market. And in there is definitely value to be had. And then there's value on top of that, as I said. One of the things we're working on right now, which is easy to talk about because it's in the public domain, It is slightly tangential to banks, but very interesting for banks. And we're working on it with HSBC, Facebook, Public Health England, and a company called Big White Wall, along with regulators. And that is for mental health. So how do you use data to help people manage their mental health? And you say, well, why is that relevant to banks? Well, it's massively relevant.
It's totally relevant to banks. In fact, you know, Brett and Moovin have a whole suite of applications for financial wellness. And, you know, mental health is a key factor in determining financial wellness of an individual and of a family. Now, I think, but now you just suddenly have me worried about Facebook knowing about my mental health and using it to track my money. Should I be worried?
No, you definitely shouldn't, because it wouldn't be Facebook or even the bank that would roll this sort of service out. So as we started experimenting with this service, we had Public Health England, we had Big White Wall, which is a mental health service bank, and Facebook. And looking at how do we create a service that would use multiple sources of data to enable you and me to manage our mental health. And everybody went, hang on a second, that could be a disaster. If Facebook rolled it out, this would be a disaster.
Yeah, like Libra, right?
But they were the first people to say exactly that. It needs to be somebody that you and I would trust, and we went through, would it be your GP, would it be your therapist, would it be... But there's definitely a role for somebody to play, and it's probably an entrepreneurial role, but a trusted entrepreneurial role. So, for instance, something like Big White Wall, maybe less entrepreneurial, but maybe something like Bupa, the big insurance companies, would be interesting as well. But it's really interesting and valuable for the banks because it is about...
So, you know, I worked with a Spanish bank a couple of years ago on a data privacy project. And what we realized is that one of the things banks are really good at is being custodians, right? So holding assets safely on behalf of other individuals and households and companies. So I think that custodian role is something that banks immediately understand, right? You talk to a client in banking and say, hey, what about custodying data? Right. And then they get it immediately. So Facebook is not great at that. And big tech is not great at being custodians. They're great at, you know, crunching that data. They're great at imagineering and creating new products and services very, very, very quickly. But that custodian role doesn't, you know, that's just not familiar. So I think if that's probably where there is a huge opportunity for partnership between banks or fintechs, regulators and big tech somewhere.
There definitely is. And the thing that we've been looking at is taking data from multiple sources, such as my Fitbit data, my activity data, my sleep data, my media consumption data, and my finance data all together. And there was a question at the beginning when we started looking at this, which is, well, you know, can't you just read it all from your finance data? Well, if you think about that data that I just spoke about, your activity data definitely doesn't rock up in that, and neither does your sleep data.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, Brett has written in his book, I think Banks 4.0, that one of the things that big tech does really well and banks don't historically is context, right? Mm-hmm. Because the context is always with, let's say, Amazon.com or with Facebook or Fitbit. They know what I was doing when I made a financial transaction. Right. So all that a bank knows is the name of the merchant I paid at what I bought, maybe not. And, you know, what was the time and so on. But the richness of the data big tech has or some of the e-commerce firms have is just incredible. And I think combining those in a way that protects privacy can create a lot of interesting products and services for customers that we haven't even thought about. So, yeah, I mean, if you have any other examples or any advice, so I think we're coming to the close of 30 minutes. What advice would you give fintech entrepreneurs and banks, especially fintech entrepreneurs, about using privacy as an opportunity in creating their, you know, computational math and AI-driven products and services?
So, Ajay, I wonder if I could answer a different question, if that's okay.
Sure, please go ahead.
So I think going back to the previous question, there's another very big element to the opportunity to open up value in our economy, especially around Europe, and that is one of investment. And what's pretty obvious is that one of the reasons the Americans can move very fast is because when they move, they bring large amounts of money often from their pension funds. Whereas in Europe, the pension funds are not involved particularly in bringing large amounts of money to invest in the high-tech markets.
Yep.
And that completely delimits our ability to move fast in this market.
100%.
We work with lots and lots of innovators and entrepreneurs, and I've run up a number of digital businesses myself. We can get early stage money. You can't get second stage money. It's very difficult to exit anywhere for an investor in Europe. You have to get America to exit. We haven't got that sort of second stage.
No, we haven't got those long horizon LPs that can wait for investments to produce returns over 8, 10, 11 years. That's correct.
And that's a real problem. Now, we've started to build out a whole entrepreneurial market, which means there's starting to be a community of entrepreneurs that can actually be invested in and have got a track record. I just don't see that coming forward with the investment that we need in this market. So if you ask me, what would you advise entrepreneurs right now, I'd say go to the States and do it there. The problem is...
or China.
Well, the problem with both of those is they don't have the same privacy regulation, mm-hmm. They don't have the same cultural environment within which to operate.
Yep.
Go get some money from those countries, certainly from America. I'm not sure I would say so from China. So... but because of the implications of follow-on investment and entry into the final entry into the market associated with that. But we're lacking that. And if as Europe, we could actually open up those second, third round investment markets, then I think we could run very fast.
And at that absolutely.
Point, at that point, privacy and how we govern our data will become a complete differentiator for our economies.
Okay, so two more questions at the end. The first is, I rarely see a fintech sell privacy as a value proposition to customers, right? Even though there have been a lot of privacy issues in the market with Equifax and whatnot, I never see an ad out there or an email saying, hey guys, we are the best neobank or we're the best payment app for you to use because we are just better at privacy. Nobody is trying to sell privacy to the European customer, even though the Swiss and the German customers in particular are very, very sensitive to the idea of privacy. Why is that?
So I think there's a really two interesting elements to that. One is whenever we test out new services with consumers and bring privacy to the fore, it creates a problem rather than solves a problem. So you can talk to them about and show them and work with them on amazing apps. But as soon as you say, and by the way, it's all private, they say, oh, hang on a second. Now that's a difficulty. I've just shared all this data and I don't think I feel comfortable with that. So as soon as you talk to it and point to it, it causes them to cognitively connect with the privacy issue. And that means that they don't actually, the uptake is poor. So how do you solve that? How do you solve a problem with that? So what I think is really interesting is what the European Commission is doing at the moment. They're looking into licensing privacy-enhancing technologies. Mm-hmm. And they've done in India. So they've licensed data facilitators, personal data management services.
Right.
Well, then potentially, so they're looking at the potential of having a kite mark for those services. Mm-hmm. So what have we done in other markets? In other markets where there's a trust...
But this is the interesting part, right? In India, we created a big privacy problem first. So there was Aadhaar, and then Aadhaar data was misused by a number of parties. And then the government acted and said, all right, we need to really create standards and some kind of a mark for privacy. So in Europe, I mean, we have done a great job of regulation, but have we really done as good a job of innovation? And if not, then, I mean, what do we need to do? And that's really the last question from me.
But if you've got a kite mark, then people can trust it. So to your point of privacy and trust, I think you need something that says this service can be...
We need to create a kite mark in Europe? Mm-hmm.
This is exactly what the European Commission are looking at, creating
awesome.
A mark and licensing those sorts of services. So that's really key. But for entrepreneurs, I think you've got to be creating not just the value, but also the structures inside your organisation that enables the data to flow in an ethical way. And actually, it's not just about governance and ethics. It's also about how your user experience works. And you've got to be transparent and offer control to the individual. Mm-hmm. As soon as you start to be very opaque about what's happening with the data, most people have a question mm-hmm. about it. They might use it, but in the end, it's not a sustainable opportunity.
So Liz, you talked about financial wellness and mental health. A big factor in influencing customers' financial wellness is the level of debt, right? So in the US, there is a lot of credit card debt. For a lot of young people, there is student debt and so on in Europe as well. Have you seen any applications in that area?
I think there's a huge opportunity in the debt management area. If you think about what we're going through at the moment with the COVID-19 lockdown, what's that doing to our economies? Most banks have been are very clever at managing, tracking their risk based on historic understanding of people's risks. But at the moment, we're just facing into a time when individuals' risk profiles will change overnight with unforeseen changes. So how banks manage that, it is going to be very difficult, and that's an existential threat on the balance sheet and bottom line for banks. Mm-hmm. There's an opportunity to use personal information to help people and individuals spot that. So if you can help them understand whether or not their job, their market is at risk, start to spot those sorts of issues coming early, that's one way of managing it. If you can also speed up their chances of finding another job, direct them into finding new skills, where there's new market opportunities. Banks have all this knowledge. Banks know what markets are growing and mm-hmm. not growing. Mm-hmm. They can bring that to bear and bring that power to the individual and help the individual manage not falling into debt and or getting out of the situation that they've got themselves into. In a way that's not just about managing money, but about managing their lives.
Wow. This is making me very, very emotional because, you know, historically, I think of the credit card companies and banks as not so much helping me with my financial situation, but essentially, you know, not really thinking that much about me. So this kind of fundamentally changes the relationship between financial institutions and fintechs and the customer, where you essentially, there is this a next level fiduciary type responsibility or a certain amount of care that you can bring to the financial relationship, primarily because you have data that nobody else does, right? So for example, Silicon Valley has data about me that's very contextual, is very rich, but they don't actually know where I'm spending my money. And having data about my financial situation and combining that with personal data draws a very, very rich picture of what my real needs are. And if that can be done in a privacy preserving way, I think that's a fundamental shift. And are you seeing any products in this area? I mean, should we expect a big product announcement?
It's early days on that, but we're in the midst of bringing together a number of organizations. If anybody's interested in participating in that, to bring together that data set, the rich contextual data set, along with the financial data set, to then look at how we can create new services for individuals and put banks back into a really relevant position mm-hmm. in people's lives, helping yeah. them.
It's about relevance, isn't it?
Absolutely, relevance yeah. in people's lives.
Yeah, okay. I mean, we could go on and on. I mean, this is a topic, you know, I could talk to you, given your level of expertise in this area for 2 or 3 hours, but now we are really coming to the close of our 30-minute time. So where can our listeners find you? How can they learn more about the work you're doing, and what's the best way to reach you on the web?
Well, I would like to say that, you know, we can all meet in a pub somewhere, but obviously under lockdown, that's not going to be possible. So the best place to go is to look at www.control-shift.co.uk, and you'll find our materials up there, various videos, etc. That's probably the best place to go. There's a lot on the web around the work that we've done with governments, organizations around the world, including WEF, regulators, legislators, large think tanks. So go to our website, you'll find a fair bit there. Search for us around the internet, you'll find a lot there.
Great. Thank you so much, Liz. We would love to have you back on our show at some other time. Appreciate your time today. And this is Ajit Tripathi, signing off from Breaking Banks Europe. Hopefully this was really, really useful. And thank you to our listeners, and Liz, to you for joining us today. Thanks.
Do you want to be part of Breaking Banks Europe? Reach out and learn more about the opportunity to be featured in one of our shows. With over 1.6 million listeners and counting, Breaking Banks Europe is bound to become the place to advance critical dialogue in Europe and the UK fintech scene. Reach out on Instagram or Twitter at Breaking Banks EU, or go to www.provoke.fm.
Hello, and welcome to the 35th episode of Breaking Banks Europe. Today, we have a really interesting topic and two awesome guests with us. And with me, I have my co-host, Matthias Kroner. Hi, Matthias.
Hey there. Hey, how are you?
Welcome back. And I have Gil Perry, CEO of DID, who are there to serve and protect photos and videos from face recognition.
Hey, happy to be here.
And we have Fabian Eberle, co-founder of Keyless, which is a cybersecurity company building biometric authentication solutions.
Hi. Hello, everyone. Thank you very much for having me.
Awesome. So today we have a really interesting topic, right? So these days, it's very hard to spend 5 minutes on Twitter without seeing the words AI or privacy roll in front of your eyes. So we thought we would just combine those two fascinating buzzwords and talk about AI and privacy and how these things are related and what impact all of the innovation in artificial intelligence and machine learning is having on privacy, you know, in terms of either creating opportunities or in terms of putting customers' data and assets at risk in terms of their data privacy. So thank you for joining. Gil, why don't you introduce yourself to get us started and describe what you're working on and how that relates to how you use AI and to protect privacy?
Sure. So I'm Gil Perry, CEO and the co-founder of DID. And what, as you said, what we do is we protect privacy in photos and videos, protect from face recognition. And we have two main solutions, use cases. One is protecting photos and one is protecting videos. So when we protect photos, we sell mainly to B2B2C organizations, channels to consumers, the organizations that store most of our photos. And we take photos, we process them. The result are photos that look very similar to the human eyes, but they're actually very different. And face recognition engines will not be able to recognize the people in the photos anymore. So it's for protecting privacy, protecting against governments or organizations such as Clearview, HiQ, Entech Labs, which are scraping our photos. And then when we go out to protest or we use dating apps or just upload our photos, we will be protected. That's one use case. The second use case is our video anonymization solution, where we target mainly mobility and CCTVs. These organizations are capturing today petabytes of videos. Cars are now all putting driver monitoring systems to make sure we don't fall asleep, and CCTVs are everywhere. And they want to capture as much information as they can, upload it to the cloud, and use AI for many use cases. And they have a very big problem, which is GDPR and privacy regulations, which are excellent policies. So they need to blur the faces. And then they lose all the important information which they wanted, such as age, gender, emotion, gaze direction, gender, etc. What we do, instead of blurring the face, we replace the faces in the video with computer synthesized non-existing people, which, unlike the photo solution, they look completely different, but they have the same features, same attributes, same age, gender, gaze direction, emotion, state, if you are tired, if you are drunk, etc., if you have a fever. So the companies can now upload the footage to the cloud. They are compliant with the GDPR. They protect your privacy, and they can still use AI to train on this data. They can still look at the data, and they can even monetize the data.
Awesome. We'll ask you a lot of questions about that. Fabian, what's your story? What are you building?
Yeah. Hello, everyone. My name is Fabian Eberlen. We at Keyless are a deep tech B2B cybersecurity company building privacy-preserving, passwordless biometric authentication and personal identity management solutions that are based on more than 10 years of research in biometrics and cryptography, with products for the workforce, allowing organizations to embrace passwordless and protect the remote workforce, and consumers, enabling businesses to strongly authenticate their users with a simple look in a front-facing camera of any device without depending on a particular hardware vendor or operating system. And to ensure the privacy in the authentication process, we're combining privacy-enhancing technologies such as zero-knowledge proofs or secure multi-party computation with machine learning and modern biometric authentication methods to strongly authenticate a user without involving personal identifiable information, where we don't store any personal data on the user's device, nor in any central point on the server side. So for the user, there's nothing you need to remember. You authenticate with who you are. You always remain in control of your personal data, which in fact means that this is compliant to privacy regulations such as GDPR by design, as we're not involving PII. And we offer multi-factor security by design, where we first verify the user's trusted device through a cryptographic proof on that particular device. And then independent of that, the physical biometric using facial recognition, we also ensure the person is a real human being and not a video or picture. And very soon we will introduce behavioral elements as another third factor in the authentication process without introducing any added friction, such as keystroke dynamics or the way you swipe on the screen. So with a one-look process on any device, you have PSD2 and GDPR compliant strong customer authentication, either for the workforce as a passwordless or frictionless single sign-on or universal multi-factor, or for the consumers as a strong customer authentication solution that makes banking and our everyday lives much easier than the PIN codes we currently copy and paste.
Awesome. So yeah, so this is getting very technical very quickly, right? Because of the nature of the topic, and that's a good thing and a bad thing. What does this actually mean for a layperson like me using my mobile banking apps and so on? So, you know, I look at all of these videos of people in China going through airports freely. So this whole idea of face recognition and biometric authentication is a huge convenience, right? I don't have to remember my password. I can go through airports, access the services, my phone and everything on it very, very quickly. And it reduces all of the friction. But at the same time, I end up then sharing my data with the third parties in ways that I may or may not want to. So it seems like we're trying to, you know, have the cake and eat it too. So we want to be able to use our data to make our lives easier, but we also want to protect that data from the services that need to see that data to allow us to use those services, right? So for example, my bank account. So Gil, what's the big idea? I mean, if you essentially protect my images from being, you know, identifiable, but can I still use them with the services I need to use them with?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And exactly as you said, face recognition is like a double-edged sword, right? So it has good use cases, like when you're lazy or when you want to use some financial services or finding missing people or bad people, etc. But it has many, many bad use cases, and we're basically losing our right to privacy. So first, if you want to upload your photos to Facebook, LinkedIn, give them to your employer for ID badge, or if you want to use a dating app, etc., then of course that's the idea of our de-identification solution, where you can still use it for such use cases. If you want to use it for face recognition, for financial services, etc., KYC information, then we also have an add-on which is very related to what Fabian mentioned, an add-on that we call DID++, where basically it's also use a lot of privacy by design. Basically, instead of using your photo, we save an encrypted vector and we split it and we give one half to you and half to the company. It's encrypted, and you can, even if you get the key, you cannot decode it without a decoder, and then nobody needs to use a photo. But in cases where you need a photo, because that's how we communicate, using photos, or if the banks, many times they use KYC, driver license photos, then you can still use the photo. And in the video solution where face recognition is not needed, then we do exactly that. We replace your face with a different face that has exactly what the customer needs, the attributes of your face. And we also have on an advisory board people like Dr. Anne Kavukian, which is the developer of the concept privacy by design, and Professor Adi Shamir, which is the developer of the RSA algorithm, the S in the RSA.
Yeah, yeah.
We're so, very into exactly solving this problem.
Yeah, so that's very interesting, right? So I think there is a fundamental problem, which is, see, I have a lot of information on Facebook, you know, lots of pictures from the last 10 years, but I don't think they're monetizable, right? I mean, does Facebook really care if I'm playing with my dog, or does anyone actually care? So when does this data become sensitive or private? Because not all of the information is private, right? So when does my image become private, and when do I need to worry about protecting it?
All the time. So that's exactly what, it's not that this type of data is can be monetized. It's more the videos being used to monetize. For example, the car companies, when you drive in the car, they want to sell the data to insurers and to billboard the advertisers and to city planners, and the CCTVs want to sell it to smart cities, etc. That's where the data is for monetization. Our photos are used by first Facebook. They do want to know who are your friends. They want to know as much as possible information about you, okay, because that's then they can bring you smarter ads. But it's more other organizations, governments and organizations such as I mentioned, Clearview, they scraped our photos. Hike scraped LinkedIn photos. And Entech Labs scraped VKontakte and Twitter photos. Then they sell it to governments and to anyone who has money. And then when you go to protest, they know who you are. They can connect you with the place you work. They can know who are your friends, etc. We need to be worried. We need to protect every photo that we upload, or think twice every photo that we upload. As a short example, Tinder, for example, if you are in the LGBT community using Tinder and you go to countries such as where it's illegal, okay, there are quite a few countries where it's illegal, they can scrape your photos and using CCTVs know that you are from this community or other minorities that age from these things.
Adrian, and I would even add on to say, okay, your photograph playing that on which you play with your dog is quite monetizable, because the next social media ad for dog food is on your account, you know, and this is a very low hanging fruit. And as Jill is saying, disinformation that you obviously love dogs, you obviously love animals, whatsoever your geolocation is in it as well, and so on and so forth, is absolutely leading into this direction. And let me kind of create this umbrella of the discussion then. So it's about, on the one side, yes, Agent, you're absolutely right, it's about convenience, right? So we walk through all these kind of blocks, we see where people write, hey, I pay with my face, isn't that awesome, and so on, is convenience, because yes, we might forget our cards, yes, we might forget our PIN code, but I've never seen a person being that stupid to forget the face at all. So, yeah, so it's about simplicity. So, and let's call it like this, it's about stupidity on the one side. So convenience and stupidities, I would say, are siblings, yeah, in some sentence, on the one side. So on the other side, it's about privacy. And then I have to say it's about liberty, right? It's my civil rights. But Jill, we would maybe state by state define the term civil right differently.
Our basic human right to privacy.
Yeah, it's about privacy. And on the other side, of course, it's about security, right? I want to have, now coming to my banking account, I want to have a secure account. I want to be sure that I cannot, my account, it finds itself to be as difficult as possible to hack it, you know? In the same time, I have maybe I'm illiterate, I cannot really write or read. You know, when we had the examples in South Africa where you have to have a fingerprint on the ATM, and then suddenly people started to chop off the finger in order to use your finger for that ATM, which really happened, as we know. And then we integrated temperature reading into the fingerprint to make sure it's not a cold finger, and so on and so forth. So obviously that was not a good development at all. So I think it's about liberty, privacy, civil right protection, security, and convenience. If we find a master way on this, I would appreciate that.
Right. It's like, you know, that's what I said. It's we want to have the cake and eat it too, as we say in England. So, Fabian, you are doing something equally interesting, right? You're essentially trying to simplify authentication. So you're kind of like on the other side of this debate.
Yes. But just to add on what has just been said, I think it all can be subsumed under the frame of trust, where I think, yes, privacy as a fundamental human right and nothing we can trade is essential in, and I think can coexist with commercial success. I also believe that privacy protections like GDPR or CCPA in principle are good, but what it really takes is a look beyond privacy to more of a tech reform. And I think this belief of a surveillance society, especially here in Europe, is not so much driven by certain governments, but actually in the interactions we have online in our own digital lives. And the fundamental element here is that the question of the incentives that drive this mass data collection that Gil just mentioned and the underlying business model that these companies are having. At the core, it's that behavioral advertising model that companies like Google or Facebook and others engage in, where they say their products and services are free. We interact with them, but in fact, we all pay, and we all pay with our data. And they will collect more and more and more of it, and they collect that data, use AI and machine learning algorithms to essentially manipulate us as users in actions that drive their profits, whether that's clicks, purchases, or insights that are generated through these analytics, as Gil mentioned with the photos, based on these data. So the problem with, I would say, a law or a regulation is that it can't really be that specific, and innovation is driving these boundaries. I, as a user, I love personalization. I love customization. So I think one way to make that happen is to shift to how we perceive privacy as a function and what role it plays within this innovation process. And I think how this is linked to the business model that underpins that, from moving from a mere, I would say, compliance and risk management perspective, as it is seen with most of the customers and companies we're talking with, to essentially become an enabler for economic success or a differentiation in how users perceive a brand.
I'm going to interrupt there, right? So let's get very, very specific, because, you know, we are in Europe. And, you know, I travel around the world, well, or I used to travel around the world when before we had this virus thing. And see, privacy isn't an absolute right or a value in all parts of the world, right? So in China, for example, privacy is considered very differently. And you can't go to Twitter or LinkedIn these days without seeing some exciting new innovation that's come out of China, which is well ahead of anything Europe or the US can achieve, right? Now, India has Aadhaar. And Aadhaar has had lots of privacy issues, but it's created a digital identity infrastructure and given everyone a bank account, right? So in the US, privacy, you know, Facebook came out of the US, and now it's a little bit of an afterthought. There are privacy rules, but nothing like the GDPR. And even in Europe, we have a little bit of this schizophrenia, right? So on one hand, we are very worried about Facebook and Google using our data, but we are not so worried about the government accessing our data. Even in GDPR, there are lots of derogations or rather exemptions for governments to access everything that we are worried about Facebook accessing. So it's not all that quite simple or black and white, right? So privacy is a really complicated topic. So we're not going to get into, you know, too, if we could really get too philosophical about it. So instead of doing that, I think let's think about contextualizing that in the context, you know, in the frame of a user using your products. So Fabian, the way I see it, you're trying to get rid of knowledge-based authentication, right?
Yeah, exactly. So if you think of authentication, and I would say the three factors we all know about, either a knowledge factor like a password or PIN, an inheritance factor like our biometrics, whether it's physical ones like faces or fingerprints or behavioral elements, and then a possession factor like the devices or hard tokens, RSA tokens that we may have used in enterprise contexts in the past. And I mean, yes, we see this whole space around authentication and identity management as fundamentally broken today. Whereas users, we're all used to using passwords and PINs to access our online services, which isn't only cumbersome for us and inconvenient, but also for the business who has to securely store.
Yeah, lots of credit card fraud and lots of, you know, chargebacks and whatnot.
Exactly. And manage that data, especially when it comes to biometrics, which is typically done in a central database that attracts all these hackers and data breaches we read about on a constant basis that result in compromised privacy on the one hand, but also in a significant financial burden on the other hand. So if you think of the evolution coming from passwords out of the 1960s over hard tokens to soft tokens, SMS, 2FA on the consumer side, to biometrics as we use them today, local biometrics, we all think of Apple's Touch or Face ID systems that partially solve the user experience issues around passwords and having to remember something, but come with their own quite severe limitations around interoperability, reach, and thus penetration of these solutions, as you essentially become married to one particular device. And from the company's point of view, the authentication is dependent on the end user device your employee or user is using. And what we are pioneering with Keyless is the world's first privacy-preserving biometric authentication solution, where we are combining these privacy-enhancing technologies with biometric authentication methods that make the authentication independent of the device, and we don't involve any personal information in the process.
So, Fabian, what will be the user experience like? Let's say, you know, your product gets integrated into Revolut or Starling or one of those mobile banking apps. What changes for the average customer?
No, it will essentially look and feel like Face ID, but on all your devices, whether that's an Android device, whether that's an iPhone without Face ID capability, whether that's a tablet, a laptop with a built-in camera, or a thin client that doesn't have a camera and you receive a push notification in your device and you put in your face. But you essentially have a unified facial recognition experience that's independent of the hardware vendor or the operating system. And what we're essentially doing is not only biometric authentication. This is one use case, and especially multi-factor authentication. So you don't have to have that second factor, or the second factor is implicit with the trusted device that you use, which can be any device that you want to use and not dependent on, say, a particular vendor like Apple.
Okay.
But what we're doing is biometric key management. So at the end of the authentication process, you recombine or reconstruct through secret sharing your personal, your cryptographic key, your private key on the device that would essentially allow for other use cases like signing signatures, etc.
And where is AI in all this? I mean, so far we heard a lot about cryptography, but...
We are not using biometric data, and AI and the machine learning comes in where, as Gil mentioned as well, we don't use biometric data per se, but we extract biometric features and transform these features. And this feature extraction happens locally on the user's device. These machine learning and AI algorithms happen on the device. And once these features are extracted and encrypted and split in shares, we're not talking about biometric information anymore, which makes it quite powerful and not only preserves the privacy in the process, but also gives the control of the authentication process to the user and makes that biometric the root of trust rather than the device as
so
we know
Matthias,
it.
Matthias, this is a question for you, right? All of this seems to be turning into some kind of opaque magic that an average customer can no longer understand.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm very happy that you pulled me into this, because actually, in between companies and various governments we discuss, we have different scenarios. And with the government, by the way, I want to add in another component is I'm very happy that the companies do collect and secure this data when it comes to KYC and so on. We talk about regulation. We must do so. We even must store that for 10 years and as long as the account is around. We have audits on that. The regulator comes along and double checks on that. But what happens if I, as a company, I'm not, operating on a state-of-the-art infrastructure and somebody's stealing the data? You know, I would say this is another very critical component to the whole thing, irrespective of AI, Egypt, because you asked me that. So, yeah, well, I'm happy for any kind of encryption, just to end up the other discussion, Fabian.
So Gil, you have something very clearly going on with, what is it, convolutional neural networks, if I were to try to impress people. I mean, what are you doing with the photos to make my wife still recognize me, but not the law enforcement people?
Exactly.
Yeah, so, but now it will get a little bit technical, but it's interesting. So basically, what we do in high level, we use AI against AI, okay? But it's an iterative optimization process. So you can think about it like a min-max problem, set of equations, where, like a parabola where you need to get to a minimum point. Where our input is an image, any type of image in the photo solution. Let's say high resolution, 1 million pixels. Then using our encoder, which is an AI part, we can take a photo, the matrix, and transform it into a vector, 512 most important parameters. Mm-hmm. Now, using our decoder, we can resynthesize this vector into a photo.
Okay, so you take my photo, you turn it into a bunch of numbers, and the photo looks the same, but the numbers look different.
It's like a compression kind of algorithm, but then now we're starting to add deltas iteratively in a smart way to this vector. We change the vector. It's very, very hard. It took us dozens of accumulated years of work of top deep learning experts to be able to change this vector. And later on, when you resynthesize it into a face, that the face would not look like a monster. So basically, we change the vector until we satisfy the loss function, the set of equations, which basically means in high level, we minimize the score of many face recognition engines, which are kind of orthogonal to each other.
I see.
And maximize human similarity algorithm that we've developed. Once this is done, we use a decoder to resynthesize the photo, then we use super resolution and other things, and you get the protected photo.
So this is slightly worrying, because you're telling me that to a computer, I'm just a set of numbers, right? And the second thing that worries me is that now mathematicians are playing with those numbers. And on one hand, mathematicians are trying to figure out who I am and violate my privacy. On the other hand, mathematicians are trying to protect my privacy by fudging those numbers around. So now I'm living in a world where I really don't understand anymore what's really being done to my data. And I'm completely dependent on some PhDs in cryptography and PhDs in mathematics to keep my data secure. Okay, so that's a very interesting world we live in. Now, what can an average user do in this environment to essentially, you know, make sure they have access to the right services, they're able to test and verify the products they're actually looking at? Or they don't need to be aware and somebody will take care of them? Because we can't go from a world where the government is supposed to be taking care of us to a world where some math PhDs are supposed to be taking care of us, right? That's not a good answer.
So no one will take care of us. And I suggest first, you know, to be aware. I can recommend the book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. Just be aware about what's happening and think twice when you share your photos. We are currently selling to companies. It's easier for us. Hopefully it will be in one of the phones soon and everyone can use it to upload photos, to take photos, to connect with social media. But we are getting many, many, many requests now from tons of people to launch a consumer app, and we are considering that.
Jill, are there also banks requesting that solution? Because as we are a financial services centric podcast, I would ask you, Jill and Fabian as well, is if I am the decision maker, so to say, the CIO or the CISO, the Internet Security Officer of a incumbent bank, what would you tell me then? How would you approach me?
So a Fortune 100 company, one of the largest financial organizations, is using our product. And I would recommend CISOs, any bank that stores KYC photos, facial photos, we would love to help. I believe it's a big risk. That's basically it.
Okay, Fabian?
Yeah, from our perspective for the passwordless authentication solution within the enterprise, in fact, passwords are the reason for 80% of all data breaches and 50% of all help desk calls. So there's a huge cost element in that. And a simple password reset, just in terms of time that the help desk labor costs, is $70 for a simple reset on average. So removing passwords from the experience doesn't only remove or increase or improve the user experience in it, but also have a direct impact in total cost of ownership. And on the consumer side, I mean, it's essentially making strong customer authentication much simpler for banks or payment providers and digital wallets, but at the same time, also more secure and unified in terms of experience across devices.
So let's flip the question on its head a little bit. You know, AI is very data hungry, and especially deep learning models consume a lot of data. In fact, the more data you have, the more advantage you have in terms of competition, the more competitive advantage you have. So now economies like China and India and the US, where there's a lot of scale, right? There's lots of people, lots of data being produced all the time, and it's all homogeneous, right? So it's like one country, one political system. Europe is highly fragmented already. We have lots of different countries. You know, we try to harmonize regulation all the time. But with higher standards around privacy, are we really falling behind as a continent in artificial intelligence? Is privacy affecting our competitiveness?
Yeah, it depends. For sure, a country like China has an advantage with their mass surveillance, but then there is the minuses that come with that. But I believe that our video anonymization solution can solve exactly this gap while protecting people's privacy. So, for example, a big focus of ours is automotive companies, as I said, are putting cameras inside the car. The data monetization for car companies is estimated to be, I think, $500 billion. And the most important data is people, and that's the most sensitive data. So exactly by that, and we are now in very advanced stages with the big OEMs and T1s in Europe and in other parts of the world, but especially in Europe, and using our anonymization solution, they can now upload the footage to the cloud. They can look at the footage, improve the UX of the driver. They can train their DMS or ADA systems. They can train their AI systems, and they can even sell the data. And it's not you in the video, and you're totally compliant with the GDPR because of Recital 26 that says, if you anonymize the data, then GDPR does not apply. And then it fills the gap. It's basically maximizing privacy and basically usability of the data.
Wouldn't we think maybe also of the alternative that if a car is videotaping me, I will not have that car, you know, actually? I wouldn't buy it, maybe. Wouldn't we even think about creating offers that are not that data hungry as you describe it, Ajit? But maybe like in organic food, they're saying it's organic in its data handling. No, because honestly, if a car manufacturer would say, I only get the car if I'm videotaped, would say, be very open, right? Sorry. Yeah, speaking French in here, but this is it.
Definitely.
Yeah.
No, so you don't have much choice. The NCAP security recommendations, all the OEMs are now going to put driver monitoring systems in the car, and you're going to be photographed. And that's to save one of the highest reasons of death is drivers falling asleep. That's one. Second, insurance companies, for example, they offer you discounts, 10% discount if you are going to put a dash cam on your car. So I agree with you. And we are trying to, you know, to have a win-win situation.
I think what you're describing is really interesting, right? So I have a friend named Gela Boscovich. She's very, very popular, and Matthias and I have a common friend. She has been saying that privacy is going to become a business model in its own right, right? So far we see privacy as something that hampers business, that gets in the way of monetizing data, launching new business models and innovation. I think what you both of you are describing, Fabian and Gil, is that privacy in itself can be a source of innovation in financial services and be a business model in its own right, right? I think that's a remarkable insight. So what should an entrepreneur or a fintech entrepreneur be thinking of in terms of building privacy as a business model into our products and services?
Yeah, I would certainly agree with what you just said. And I think privacy is an integral part of products, especially in the digital identity space. I wouldn't only say privacy, but as Matthias mentioned, in combination with security, trust, to some degree, freedom or control of personal data. And this is where we see, as with Keyless, the identity space heading to a more user-centric identity paradigm, where we as users control our identity information, are able to selectively disclose data in a more private and secure way that we control, and we know where we've given consent, what degree of data we disclose with whom. There's already a lot of technical infrastructure and tools readily available today. But for this shift to happen on the consumer or from a market side for commercially viable products to emerge, I think we're still in the early days, but this is certainly the path in terms of where we see authentication and eventually identity management headed.
Yeah, and in particular, Fabian, that's really a good point. And in particular, I could assume that we are heading into times in which data on my driver is seen to be a risk or in the cloud, no matter what. But under my umbrella, under my legal umbrella, the data in this legal umbrella is seen to be a risk, and I need to underlie that with equity. On top of what I do in normal banking business, you know, so whenever I grant a loan, I have to have equity for that. Whenever I have I take deposits. I have to have equity for this. Same for trading. And the more data I have, the more vulnerable I will be, the higher the damage is, and the regulator will come back one day and say, you need to underlie this with equity because this is a natural regulator's reaction. Insecurity and volatility must be underlied with equity. If I have technical solutions like the one we discussed now and offering alternatives to the customer, I can even ease my situation as a bank when it comes to exactly that discussion. So I think even banks, for instance, and consumers would be heading and would be pulling the string into the same direction.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think first giving to the world privacy enhancing solutions such as Fabian's and the DIDs will really help that, because currently the companies just don't have tools to be able to protect our privacy.
Exactly.
I totally agree with what you said.
Of course, I need to have whatever I need to have out of the regulatory view, but I need to store it and secure it in a safe way, as you introduced it to us. However, I also must make it happen that whenever the customer wants to have the data back, we must give it back. It's not our data. I think it also always and always starts with management ethics and kind of philosophy to this, right?
For sure. Yeah, Matthias, you live in Germany, and you know, in all of Europe, after Switzerland, I found German customers to be the most privacy sensitive, right? Yeah. But I still don't see banks, fintechs, or you know, other organizations use privacy as a selling point. So we talked about privacy as a business model, but I've never seen anyone advertise that they are just better at privacy. And that's why, you know, your customers should trust them and bank with them and not with someone else. So
I see this
changing.
I can tell you, I have my guess around it. So first of all, there is one belief in at least the German speaking banking advertising market is whenever you have to stress a point, people do not believe that you're good in, you know? So if you say, for instance, we are the most customer-centric, then somebody else will say, yeah, there must be a reason, you must stress it, okay? So which means actually by saying we are the most customer-centric, you would maybe supposedly deliver exactly the opposite message. Now, if you say we are the most secure, somebody will say, listen, why is security your issue? You know, so that might be one topic on that.
Right.
But I'm fully with you, Ajit. It's whenever, you know, Fedor was my second bank, I founded. And I always said whenever I might do a third bank, it will be a total analog offline bank again. You know, it will be the opposite of what we experience today of digital. But yeah, no, because this is exactly the answer to this. I'm so scared. We had a regulated discussion the other day, and I was questioned what would I regard to be the top number one risk for a bank, and it's everything related to cybersecurity. And there was not, even with that regulatory organization, there was not a single discussion on it. Everybody said yes, you know? So yes, you're absolutely right. I would even say we must make privacy a business model. It's not only that it shall happen, we must make
it. We must make privacy, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. And then in the context of that, what we have to say is, you know, we have to stop thinking of AI as something that cannot work well with privacy. But AI in terms of, you know, it's essentially, so here is my challenge with AI, right? So a lot of AI is just advanced analytics and computational mathematics. In plain English, it is a lot of good mathematics for data. Right. And it's sold in under this massive umbrella of AI. Sometimes it involves machine learning algorithms, sometimes it doesn't. But it looks like there are lots of good solutions that can be created for privacy out of all of this AI and computational math. And this whole idea in my mind, or in a lot of customers' mind, that AI is fundamentally antithetical to privacy is actually not valid. I think a lot of good solutions seem to be coming out of AI to address some of the privacy issues that we've been dealing with. And in Europe, obviously, that's a huge opportunity because, at least in my experience, European customers are far more privacy sensitive than anywhere else in the world right now.
Actually, I would say in the times we are heading into, with all that volatility coming along with state-driven cyber attacks and all that stuff, I would say this will be a unique selling proposition when it comes to ecosystems. having a strong environment which is very sensitive on data handling, data management, definitely will be my, I'm convinced, and please grill me, and Fabian and Jill, please contradict strongly on this, but I think will be a superior system fit for the future.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think for companies who protect privacy, a few years ago, it was pretty hard. And no one cared about privacy. And it was just when GDPR was introduced. But I think these days are good. And things like GDPR and other privacy regulations are doing good. And it's a better period for companies that develop privacy-enhancing technologies. Investors are more interested in that. Customers are more interested in that. In Europe, now it's starting to be in the US. In Japan, they're very concerned about privacy. Also financial organizations in Japan. And I think that it will bring value for companies that introduce privacy-enhancing solutions and tell their employees and their customers that they protect their privacy, really protect their privacy?
Yeah, I would just add one philosophical remark from a blog that I read from Naval Ravikant, the founder of AngelList, who said that the destructive powers arrive long before the protective powers of disruptive new technology, where if you think of the discovery of the nuclear reaction to the first nuclear bomb, the time was much shorter to the trip when we got the first nuclear power plant. In the same way, we may have huge potential for AI for good if we use it responsibly with privacy built in to solve really critical issues, not just to make payments simpler or authentication in the enterprise systems, but challenges around climate change, healthcare, transportation, that all require processing and analyzing of huge sets of data, personal data, behavioral data, geolocation data, and other quite sensitive information. And if you get that right, I think we can have a pretty powerful impact to society overall.
I'm very happy, Fabian, about that more or less kind of positive outlook and remark, because it leaves us not in a dystopia, but in a hopefully positive utopia. But we're coming to the end of the show, actually, sadly, and really time was flying, because as you could see, it is a very emotional, legal, whatever, multidimensional topic. One to allow actually our listeners to have one practical takeaway, what would you recommend an incumbent banker, and we spoke about the CISO before or the CIO, what would be your single point of advice when they embrace or start embracing that topic? What minor or major thing? I don't know. Jill, you want to start, and then Fabian?
Yeah, I'll just mention the things that are relevant to DID. First, be aware that you're handling sensitive PII, or just PII, personal identifiable information. Understand the risks under GDPR. Understand privacy issues, so just care about your customers and your employees, but understand your risk of up to 4% of worldwide annual revenue of the company. Biometric data is considered not just PII, but sensitive PII. So if you have photos, KYC photos or videos, then just be aware about the risks. It's more sensitive than just regular PII.
All right. Thank you, Jill. Fabian?
I would say just the general remark of start to think of privacy, and I would include security in that as something that belongs into the boardroom or the C-level agenda and not just seen as a compliance or risk management item that needs to be ticked off, but rather, as Ajit mentioned before, as an enabler for future growth in the business and the value in the given brand of the company.
Wonderful. Yeah, fully agree. Ajit, over to you.
Yeah, I think it was really fascinating, and you know, I've been wondering for a while, you know, there is a lot of fear of missing out on Twitter, and I spend a little bit too much time on Twitter. So about China getting ahead and Silicon Valley firms getting ahead because they don't have to deal with the privacy rules we do. But I think you've just flipped the topic on its head. And if you're selling to European customers, privacy can be a huge selling point and can be a business model in itself. And you know, Europe still is a huge economic force in the UK as well. So I think there are lots of opportunities to create solutions that can be taken to other parts of the world as well. So a huge opportunity there. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks, Fabian. Thanks, Jill. It was a great show. Thanks to our host, AJ. Yeah.
Thank you. Yay. Cheers. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Thank you, everyone.
All right.
Thanks for listening to Breaking Banks Europe, a Provoke Media podcast in cooperation with FinTech Stage. Don't forget to tweet us out, shout out, or post to the team at Breaking Banks EU on Twitter. If there's something or someone you'd like to hear on our cast, let us know. See you next week on Breaking Banks Europe.